Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, are the UK's libel laws compromising academic freedom of speech? Science writer Simon Singh thinks so.
We're almost becoming kind of the China of Europe and the West. It's an embarrassing and humiliating position to be in. They can come onto the legal court, put £1 million on the table and say, right, do you want to play libel with me?
We've got a sort of interview thingy about why being vague is actually probably maybe rather important or something like that, I think.
There are only two houses here. It's only that one that could be described as the tall one. Whereas if he had said the 41-foot one, you know, it could have been the other one. You would have had to measure.
Plus, a man who's making music using telescopes at Cambridge University. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome. In the studio today from The Guardian is Nell Bowes. Nell, welcome.
Hello, hello.
This is your second time in 2 weeks. How does it feel?
Oh, it's very exciting.
You're back with full effect. Science writer Simon Singh is also here, as is campaigner Tracy Brown of Sense About Science. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
They're both here because it's Big Libel Week. This is a campaign that aims to highlight how Britain's libel laws are having a negative impact on scientific and medical discussions in this country and, inexplicably, others too. Companies and organisations from around the world are increasingly using Britain's courts to quash criticism. Simon's one of those being sued after writing about chiropractic on The Guardian's website. Now, Simon, this is an ongoing legal case, so be careful what you say. For anyone who's not got the background on this, give us a quick rundown on what's happened, how you've got to the position you're in at the moment.
Yes, the article, just to correct one thing, was in the Guardian newspaper in the comments section back in April 2008 and also on the website. And I wrote about chiropractic, and in particular, should chiropractors be treating children for conditions like asthma and colic and ear infections and so on? I thought there was a lack of evidence. The British Chiropractic Association didn't agree with that, and they sued me for libel. I think one of the extraordinary things is that was almost 2 years ago, and we're still at what's called a preliminary stage. In fact, last week, or the week before last, we were at the Court of Appeal arguing about the meaning of the article. And then maybe in 2 years' time, we'll actually have the trial and sort it out. And one of the big problems with libel is the enormous time involved and therefore also the enormous costs involved.
Tracy, people get sued all the time for libel in this country and other places too. It's a necessary protection against damage to reputations and people saying malicious things. How did Simon's case become part of what is now quite a big campaign in this country to reform the whole structure of libel?
There are kind of three things going on. One is that for over a century, there's been frustration with the laws in this country as being arcane and referring to the early days of sort of printing presses rather than mass media. And that's sort of run up against attempts to reform have just run into the sand, really. Then what we had with Simon's case was something that drew attention both to that old problem and to a newer problem, which was that the libel laws are being used to silence critics all over the world, but in the London courts, and really catalysed that reaction across the science community, but much more broadly, because what we realised was it wasn't just the scientists and the medics experiencing this, but of course human rights campaigners and others who criticise big organisations were also experiencing threat of libel as a way of shutting down discussion. So it's kind of come together that all those different groups that are affected have come together in a coalition to press
and reform. I think it's if it were just my case, I don't think anybody would care, but it's also Ben Goldacre. You know, here at The Guardian, was sued for libel last year, eventually won the case, but that cost The Guardian £150,000.
Even though he won.
Peter Wilmshurst, a very eminent cardiologist, being sued for an interview given in America at an American conference from an American online magazine to a Canadian journalist about an American company, ends up being sued back in London. Henrik Thompson, a Danish researcher, sued for libel by an American company for a lecture he gave in Oxford. So suddenly, I think people began to realise that libel is not just about salacious gossip and tittle-tattle and celebrity culture. It's about health. And if researchers and bloggers and scientists and journalists can't write about these issues, that also means that the public don't get to hear about them. And therefore, libel seems to have crossed a line.
Can you just explain, how does someone who is writing in an American newspaper about an American product get sued in London?
Well, the reason why they get sued in London is twofold. One is because we don't have a particularly high threshold. The way that our laws work is that it's so much favourable to the claimant. And you can bring a case on a fairly spurious, what most of us would think is, a fairly spurious claim that your reputation has been damaged.
So what changes are you actually looking to get made to the law?
Well, the first thing is, I think, when Simon talked about the balance between free speech and the right to reputation, and in human rights legislation, we have a right to free speech, and that is tempered by reputation. What we currently have in this country is that you have a right to reputation with the defamation laws, and then if you're lucky, you can argue that you have some free speech defence. So we want to turn that back around and rebalance that. So what we're really looking for is a public interest defence, which is to say that anybody who is pursuing a discussion that we broadly recognise to be in the public interest, whether they're talking about corporate behaviour, corruption, medicine, environment, health and safety, those kinds of issues, that they have a defence of pursuing a question in the public interest. And at the moment, there is no robust defence for anybody who finds themselves threatened with libel action.
And then just one other thing, which is the other thing that would really help, is to drive down costs enormously, because libel cases in England cost over 100 times more than the rest of Europe. So we're talking about £1 million game. So a letter arrives on your doorstep suing you for libel. One, you're guilty until you can prove your innocence. So all the burden is on you. Secondly, you could lose £1 million if you lose. You could lose £100,000 if you win. Who on earth wants to even take part in that sort of game? So you end up with people retracting, apologising for material that they actually believe to be true and accurate, but people can't even afford to defend their free speech. And that's one of the other reasons why you get this libel tourism, that people come to this country because they have some slight reputation, there's some readership of the material in this country, so they can sue here, and they can come onto into the legal court, put £1 million on the table and say, right, do you want to play libel with me, or do you want to just back down now? And people clearly, in the vast majority of cases, back down.
You've got to say, it's a really bizarre situation where something as fundamental as your right to free speech is so complex that you don't even know if you can defend your words for 2 years. I mean, actually, Simon, 2 years into the case, doesn't even know whether his defence is going to stand up in court. And you've had to spend all that money, or risk all that money. And not just that, but all that time. I mean, how many people have the flexibility in an 8 or 6 job, for example, to be able to be engaged in a libel action? Not many. So, I mean, what we're looking for is a situation where if you simplify people's understanding of their rights, they have clear defences, it becomes clearer at an early stage whether or not this case, you know, has got some mileage in the courts, and therefore it's much simpler for people to settle or arrange for, you know, for some sort of making of amends to occur at an early stage rather than 4 years on.
Given that science essentially operates by scepticism and people arguing about things in academic journals, sometimes quite vociferously disagreeing with something that's gone before. Have you found any evidence that these kinds of laws are being used to squash that academic debate? Never mind the sort of the public commercial debates or personal grudges and things, but academic discussion, i.e. the forward march of science.
Well, this is where Simon's case was really interesting. It brought out of the woodwork a rather unsayable thing, which is that a lot of peer-reviewed journals, medical and scientific journals, are being affected, and there is material that they're not publishing. It's not the sort of thing that your average editor wants to say about their journal. Oh, well, you know, I mean, really, the idea should be stuff goes in on merit, not on whether who's got the biggest, strongest lawyers.
If it's not out in public, that's presumably before they're publishing stuff.
Yeah, so what is this
pre-publication threat? How does that work?
There are a number of cases where lawyers have written and journals have taken down articles, including one on speech and language. There's a physiology case where that's happened.
But more worrying than that is the libel chill. So an editor gets a paper and the lawyer looks at it and says, look, frankly, we can't afford to publish that. We would be bankrupted and destroyed if somebody even threatened us with libel. So papers are withdrawn before they're even published. And even more perversely, there are papers that have been published and which should be withdrawn because there's a question about the veracity, the quality of the data, whether the conclusions are at all correct. And those papers should be being pulled, but journals are afraid to do that because that, again, would defame the author's reputation and they might then be open to a libel suit.
Is there any mileage in separating out the different arenas and saying, all right, there's a public interest defence available to all academic journals, or do you have to have a kind of one-size-fits-all?
The danger whenever you layer on another patch onto the existing law
becomes more complicated, and then it's harder for people to work out
exactly,
where they stand.
And all the problems of it taking a really long time, because that's another line of legal argument that would have to be won in court. So the danger there is, you know, you put so many patches on, as one lawyer said to me, you look down and realise you've got no trousers. It's just all patches, and this is why it's taking so much preliminary time to get through. So that's the problem. It also, I think, doesn't cover things like, for example, many journals publish comment, news and views, editorials, and these are all really important parts of drawing attention to new findings. And
what about conferences, for example?
Conferences wouldn't necessarily be covered either. And then we end up in sort of debates about to what extent we think the peer review system at that journal is sufficiently robust, and, you know, that's not particularly where we want to go. But there is, I think, another important point about this, which is that people sometimes separate off academic discussion as though somehow that's really dry and should be kept on a very polite level. And that then there's other stuff like the salacious journalism, and there's a few things in between. But it's very important that words that will draw attention to people's behaviour or the kinds of things that are going on are used, that strong words are used. If you're only ever euphemistic, can you imagine a situation, I think it was recently raised with me by someone in the Medical Research Council, the COX-2 inhibitors story. You actually needed to use quite strong language to raise that as an issue of public concern. It would have been the irresponsible thing to do to bury it in some euphemistic, overly polite discussion about those trials and those findings. The right thing to do is to be attention-grabbing at times. It's the same, you know, it's no different from a journalist who's war reporting and exposes something really quite horrendous. The idea that you use some neutral, hands-off headline would actually be the irresponsible thing to do. So I think we need to be careful about this idea that there's polite academic discussion and then there's rough and ready other discussion.
Yeah, I think the idea of protecting academic discussion in papers or in conferences sounds quite attractive. And there may be some mileage in it, but I think the idea of a robust public interest defence also protects people like Ben writing in The Guardian. Clearly writing on a matter of public interest, should vitamins be used to treat HIV? Well, Ben thinks not. He should be able to write that without the fear of libel. It protects people like, you know, bloggers. Bloggers are doing some of the most important journalism there is nowadays, and they also need to be protected, not if they're being scurrilous, malicious, reckless, but if they're writing reasonably and responsibly on a matter of public interest, that key buzz phrase again, then the libel laws offer them some protection rather than trying to trip them up.
Going on the other side of this, neither of you are arguing that we shouldn't have libel laws or defamation laws. It's all about where you draw the line. And where do perhaps we're drawing the line too much towards the people who want to sue you rather than being sued.
That just goes without saying. The UN criticise us. We have all these libel tourists coming here, not because our libel laws are so great, because our libel laws are so terrible.
The US government, or the federal governments, the state governments in the US are banning the use of the British libel laws for Americans.
State by state, if an American citizen is being sued in England, that judgment won't be upheld in America and American assets are safe because they have so little regard for our libel laws. So it's a no-brainer. I dare any MP to stand up publicly and say we've got good, respectable, decent libel laws, because we just clearly haven't. It's just a case of where you push them to, and that's up for debate.
So we've heard about how your cases have been going, Simon, but what support do you have from Parliament? I mean, Jack Straw seems to be interested in doing something about this.
Yeah, Tracy's on a working group at the Ministry of Justice and can talk about that in a second, but we've got over 200 MPs now signed up from all the major parties. We've got 35,000 people signed up to a petition, libelreform.org/sign, libelreform.org. Do sign up, because that's what's making the MPs sign up to the early day motion. That's what's making the politicians take notice. The Lib Dems are going to make it part of their manifesto. They're completely signed up. And maybe the most positive sign is this working group at the Ministry of Justice, which I think is now concluding its thoughts.
This week is going to be the final meeting, and Sense About Science, English Pen, the authors' organisation, and Index on Censorship have been representing our concerns as the coalition for libel reform on that group. I have to say, obviously, quite a strong showing there from claimant lawyers, and what we expect to come out of that is more of a scoping discussion about what the options are for reform rather than any kind of, believe me, it won't be consensus coming out of that discussion. But it's been a very useful exercise, and I think it has actually made the government realise that this is more than a tinkering with costs and various conditional fee arrangements before Christmas was what they were saying needed to be done. And they understand now that one of the reasons why costs are so high is because the laws are profoundly unbalanced. And I'm hopeful that something will come out of that. We've also been approaching the other political parties too to make commitments in their manifestos. It's only a matter of weeks now before Parliament's dissolved, and we're expecting to hear from the political parties as to what their manifestos are going to be. The Liberal Democrats have already made a commitment for substantial reform, and we're now expecting to see both the other political parties and main political parties in the election do that. And it's essential. I mean, people sometimes say, well, isn't this a minor issue? It's kind of tinkering with the law on the side here. It might affect, you're talking about scientists and medics, and there are other big issues. And when you look at the range of subjects that's covered by people concerned, raising their concerns from libel laws, we're talking about human rights. We're talking about people who are reporting on wars around the world, people who are reporting on corporate behaviour around the world, on clinical trials, on effectively then what the kind of drugs are that are recommended through use in our health service, because that's based on the peer-reviewed literature, which we know now is not the full picture. We've got all these issues, and I think, well, unless we can actually freely discuss them as a society, haven't we got a bit of a problem coming into election, that there are a whole number of things that are off limits for us?
You mentioned the Americans a second ago. The Americans are now saying they will not distribute their papers in England. They're now talking about blocking their websites to England because they are so scared of English libel laws. We're almost becoming kind of the China of Europe and the West. It's an embarrassing and humiliating position to be in. And there are lots of reasons to be proud of the English justice system, but the libel law is a really embarrassing aspect of it that just has to be changed very quickly. And to highlight one of the examples that Tracy was giving there, we talked about Peter Wilmshurst a second ago. He's a cardiologist. He's writing about a heart device, and he must be able to talk about that freely. If he loses his case, he will be destroyed. He will be absolutely bankrupted. And I spoke to him just last week. We had an event in London. I said to him, why are you fighting on? And he said, well, if I don't fight on, I'm not doing my job as a doctor. If I don't speak out, I'm breaking the Hippocratic Oath. And in that situation, I'd rather be sued for libel. But in many other cases, quite understandably, doctors, researchers and so on wouldn't speak out because of the fear of libel.
What Simon's saying raises a really important point about the libel laws, which is you could go for 3 years of court in something like Jarndyce v. Jarndyce. I mean, it really is like that with Simon's case, and Peter Wilmshurst is looking not dissimilar. You could go for years and years and years, and one thing you can be sure of, you can't be sure that you're going to have your house at the end. You can't be sure of whether a defence is going to stack up, and you can't be sure of how the court's going to find. But one thing you can be really sure of is that that court will not take us any further in understanding whether that heart device works or whether chiropractic is useful for infant conditions and all these issues. It will not resolve any of those things.
Okay, well, we should wind up. But one thing before we go, it's not just us scientists and medics involved in this campaign. You've got quite an interesting gig coming up there. Do you want to tell us about that?
On Sunday.
Yes.
Indeed, it's Sunday
night. Mother's Day.
The big libel gig. Einstein's birthday and Pi Day, apparently. I've just been looking up.
Pi without me.
Yes, because 314, 14th of March, that's it. We've got Dara Brien, Tim Minchin.
Ed Byrne.
Yeah, Marcus Brigstock, Shapical Sandy.
And these people are all supporting the libel campaign.
Yeah, they all understand how important it is to have free speech. I mean, someone like Dara talks about a lot of scientific issues and sails very close to the wind in a lot of his material. And you know, he's been talking with lawyers. He's discussed this issue several times in the media. I was getting letters the other week from Tom Stoppard and David Hare and Michael Frayn, realising how important it is to be able to have freedom as a playwright to discuss these issues. I was talking on Australia Radio the other day with a biographer, Patrick French. Biographers are affected by this. You name it. We've got the Astronomer Royal supporting us. We've got the Poet Laureate supporting us. And if you out there want to support us, it's www.libelreform.org. Please, please do sign up.
Sounds like getting sued, Simon, has been great for your social life. This is fantastic.
Great for my address book, yeah.
Well, the big libel gig is on at London's Palace Theatre on Sunday, the 14th of March. I think the tickets are all sold out, but you can get more information about it and probably some clips, hopefully, soon at libelreform.org, where you can also sign up for the campaign. Leave your thoughts on any of these issues at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And while you're there, make sure you subscribe to our podcast so that it's delivered for free every time there's a new episode. It takes all the hard work out of listening. Next, let's head over to Cambridge.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Matthew Carl Applegate, aka Pixel Hate, and we're here at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge University. I'm here doing a project called Observations, which is based on the people, the practices, and the data they collect. And I'm turning that all into music for two performances on March 12th and 13th as part of the Cambridge Science Festival. But first, let me take you on a tour of all the telescopes to show you where I got all the amazing sounds from. Which one are we going to go to first? This one's got a little motor. Right now we're currently inside of the Northumberland telescope, and as you can already hear, it changes the acoustic properties of my voice. And in here there's a small thing like the actual drive motor for the telescope itself, and it's actually quite quiet when you turn it on, but if you go really close to it, you can hear this lovely kind of humming noise. I actually took that sound from the drive motor, and that underpins a lot of the music within Observations, and it gets bent around and shifted to form kind of harmonious parts later on in the music as well. There's also the sounds of, say, moving the lens cap from the telescope, the opening of the shutters, the shifting of the actual dome itself, and those also form part of the music. In this telescope here, the Thorogood, I was kind of interested in the clicking and kind of clanging sound that we have here that you use to adjust the actual telescope. And after I'd done the kind of field recording of it, I thought I could actually resample it and turn that into a very heavily rhythmic piece. And again, it's using what's here on site and turning that into the music itself, as opposed to me making music inspired by it. It's me using actual things that are here. This was Arthur Eddington's house. It's quite nice. But now it's the library. They've given me a key. What we're looking at here is the Internal Constitution of the Stars by Arthur Eddington. And it's a very important book. But what I found even more fascinating is that we have two exact copies of it in the library. And on one of the copies, as you can see, somebody's decided to essentially rewrite history and add in their own graphs and charts and information. And I quite like that it was knowledge that was slowly being kind of overlaid over other people's from the past. And you can then look at the second copy, which is in pristine order, and it doesn't have any of these. But it's fascinating to see what other people have added to his work. And it's very similar to what goes on here at the Institute as a whole, because people are just overlaying their knowledge on other people's work. And essentially that's what I'm doing with my music. I'm taking their knowledge and transferring that into to inform my music. The things that they've added to it is mind-blowing. just going to demonstrate some of the sound recordings that I've taken from the Institute of Astronomy and the researchers there and how they helped inform the music. Their actual speech patterns were sampled and then turned into rhythms that would be used in the music later on.
Sound does travel through space in spite of what people tell you. Space isn't completely empty. But sound travels quite quickly through space, even. But for detailed studies, you really need to be close to something to measure the sounds.
One of the most fascinating sounds that we came across was actually the Schmidt telescope. At the very, very end of the opening of it, it has this kind of purring kind of sound, and I'll just play you that now. We're here in the Sackler Lecture Theatre, where I'll be performing on March the 12th and 13th. Behind me is a very large screen, which I'll actually be beaming 25 minutes of visuals, again, inspired by the people, the practices, and the machinery at the Institute of Astronomy. The whole project itself is in association with the Cambridge Science Festival. Their website is cambridgescience.org. It's funded by the PRS for Music Foundation. And if you'd like more information on me and what I'm doing, you can follow me on Twitter, and that's PixelH, PIXELH8.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
If you've ever been criticised for being too vague, we've got a robust scientific defence for you. Being inexact is actually important. For example, what does describing someone as blonde mean? Or overweight? In general speech, there's no particular value those words apply to. And it's not just a side issue. Programmers are now even training computers how to be vague. To make things a little clearer, we spoke to Kees van Diemter, who's written a book called Not Exactly. He's from the computer science department at the University of Aberdeen, which is somewhere in the world.
Vagueness is a big topic among certain types of computer scientists and linguists. They tend to think of vagueness as a big problem. Now, if you see how vague terms are used in daily life, it struck me that in many cases there shouldn't be a problem. So, to start with a really simple example, suppose you're standing in front of two houses. One is a little bit taller than the other, yeah? And you want to indicate that the taller of the two needs to be demolished, and quickly, yeah? Maybe there's a real hurry there. Now, what would work better? We work better if you said the 41-foot building needs to be demolished, or would it work better to say the tall one needs to be demolished? That's much clearer, because people would simply argue, you know, there are only two houses here. It's only that one that could be described as the tall one. Whereas if you had said the 41-foot one, you know, it could have been the other one. You would have had to measure.
So clarity can lie in vagueness.
Indeed.
In the book, you talk about what makes a person. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
It's actually easiest to illustrate, not by talking about a person, but talking about, for example, a car. There's a famous court case where someone bought a vintage racing car for £20 million. It won all kinds of races in the 1920s. But he found out that one after another, all the main parts of the car were changed, were repaired, and you know, replaced by other parts. So he argued it's no longer the same car, right? In the same way, our bodies, right, the cells in our body, change all the time. So, yes, of course, intuitively, I'm still the same person now as I was 20 years ago. But it's just not so easy to pin down at what point one object becomes another.
And you see this all feeding into, I think in the book you talk about how ideas of vagueness are going to be important for things that you're already touching on, like artificial intelligence, the way where humans interact with computers.
Exactly. So that's where my own research comes in and that of my colleagues here at Aberdeen. Take, for example, doctors. We're working on systems, my colleagues are working on systems that measure all kinds of things in patients, babies, for example. Lots of numbers being measured, yeah? And the challenge there is to extract the gist from those numbers and present that information to other doctors, yeah? So we start analyzing transcripts from one doctor writing to another at the end of a night shift and seeing this is the condition of the baby. And what we see is that they use vague terms all over. So this is all about breathing, so stuff like oxygen saturation. They write, oxygen saturation is very variable. Usually the desaturations are down to so-and-so, though a few times, you know, and it goes on like that. So that's the first observation, that just like in my example of the tall house, even when you try to be, even when doctors try to be really precise and, you know, exact, they find it helpful to use those vague terms. Now, that's the kind of behavior that seems to be really useful and that we try to imitate when we let computers generate similar transcripts. We call it natural language generation, where typically you have something like numbers as input, and in situations where people find it very difficult to make sense of those numbers, and then the output that our machines produce is sentences, is little texts. We would like to build systems that produce texts of that kind and that are sort of even better because they take all the information into account and make all the right choices in how everything's expressed.
Kees van Diemte speaking to Ian Sample. Not Exactly in Praise of Vagueness is out now. There's nothing at all vague about our Facebook group, which we've called the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. There you can chit-chat with other listeners, post comments, look at pictures, and generally entertain yourself at will. And if you join, producer Andy will send you a reminder every Monday morning when a new podcast is uploaded.
Science Weekly.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Nell Bose from The Guardian, and also to Simon Singh and Tracy Brown. Remember, the Big Libel gig takes place at London's Palace Theatre on Sunday, the 14th of March. If you want more information and if you want to sign up to the campaign, go to libelreform.org. Next week, there'll be some eerie silence as the eminent physicist Paul Davis comes into the studio. We'll look at why your brain behaves differently at the theatre and take you around a new exhibition at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. Don't forget to add your voice to our website, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you can also follow this podcast on Twitter. Look for Science Weekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. We're going to end this week's show with more of the Observations composition, which will be performed at the Cambridge Science Festival.